So please help me welcome the president of the Theosophical Society in America very warmly and with so much respect, Brother Tim Boyd.
I want to thank Danellis for the lovely introduction, although she did leave out some of the elements that I had asked her to include, probably wisely so, because the sorts of things I was asking her to say was things like, don't forget to tell them that when God created the earth, he said that Tim would be here at one point. And don't forget to tell them about the work that I did on the pyramids. Wisely, she skipped all of that. But it's very good to be here, very good to talk with you. What I'm going to be talking about is, broadly put, we could say it's illumination. Illumination. But particular sort of illumination that we're going to be talking about, because we're going to be talking about the illumined mind. And rather than view it as some sort of event that happens to us, I'd prefer to think of it in terms of actually a process. You know, because there is very often, and I think maybe it's, I was going to say probably it might be just sort of an American way of looking at things, that we're very goal-oriented. So, you know, enlightenment, we want enlightenment, and we see it as some single event that occurs, overlooking the fact that there's an entire process that brings us to this particular moment that then becomes defined as the experience of enlightenment. So illumination of the mind is what we're going to be focusing on some today. And I should say, this process of moving toward a state that we could say of being illumined, like many things, it has a beginning. And probably, if we were to kind of analyze it and look at ourselves, you could say that the movement that we have that takes us in the direction of even feeling a need for something like a state of illumination or a clearer way of seeing has its beginnings in what we might call a state of profound dissatisfaction. Basically, it's kind of a personal thing in the sense that at some point, I mean, particularly for anyone who finds themselves involved with anything that might be termed a spiritual path, you don't get there, generally, because everything is rosy, and the world is wonderful, and all is okay at every moment. Generally, what directs people to some sort of a interior quest is some state of dissatisfaction. Basically, we find ourselves at some point feeling that something's not right, either with ourselves or with the world when we look out upon it. There's something we feel that is missing. And very often, that's the thing that kind of drives us to try and look more deeply at ways of correcting it. You know, we have all sorts of ways of thinking about this thing initially. But this is what sort of motivates us to look for more. The fact that somehow or another, we feel that there's a piece of the puzzle that we call us that's missing. And we have various ways of describing what that piece might be. So very often we feel that it's something that there's a certain happiness that we're not feeling. Or that there is, in fact, some kind of peaceful way of being that we find ourselves sitting outside of that somehow. Or, you know, that the world needs to be more compassionate, more kind. We find that there's a freedom that we may feel ourselves lacking. And these are the sorts of things that kind of move us to this search for this as yet indefinite something that we feel is out there somewhere. But it's very, very important, you know, that we engage in this. one of the problems with this whole questing aspect also is that, you know, the search begins with dissatisfaction. Yet while we're searching, it's not too satisfying either. I mean, when you face it, anyone who has some sort of meditative practice or who has developed these sorts of approaches to the spiritual life, you will find that you will have moments of peace that confirm that this is a good direction. But somehow or another, that peace has a way of dissolving into some sort of chaotic experience. Or, you know, we'll find that we have experiences of happiness, which always, always, always somehow kind of slip through our fingers. There's no way to just kind of finally hold it. And so that's not satisfying either. And what you find is that very often people who have kind of commenced this sort of questing activity, begun a search, can feel very, very frustrated. And at certain times, you even have people who will say, I've had enough. I mean, actually, I heard someone tell me the other day that there has been a large growth in the way of thinking that's generally described as atheism. That, you know, the idea that there is no being or there is no greater power, there is no God that can be involved in this universe. And it apparently, according to what this person was saying, it kind of tracks from September 11th, 10 years ago, in terms of the experience here in the U.S. That so many people found themselves asking the question, how can something so horrific happen in a universe that is governed by some sort of compassionate, loving God? And, you know, in their thinking process, they'd go through the thoughts and it couldn't quite line it up, and so they decided that there must not be any such sort of orchestrating force in the universe. And so you have this kind of frustration, basically, an expression of an inability to unravel this sort of mystery of what it is that we're here for and how it is that we can actually live wholly in this world. So you have those sorts of frustrations that have a variety of ways of expressing themselves. I think one of the main ways that we find it expressed in our contemporary culture, and probably all of us are prey to this one, if I were to ask you, do you know anybody, and I've asked this question, there's probably one person in the room that I know that could answer yes. Do you know anybody, and he's back there chuckling right now, who is not busy? That's not supposed to be a ridiculous question. But, you know, at least to me, I know a lot of different people from a lot of different walks of life. And the ones I know, makes no difference what level their employment is, makes no difference if they're employed at all. Every single person I know, from someone getting a welfare check to someone governing an entire large company, is busy. No time. Can't do it. You know, got to schedule you in. You know, it's like, we'll do lunch, maybe. So, you know, this is sort of like a condition of our time. Everybody is busy. And, you know, while we're busy, we're doing things. But I think in large measure, a lot of what this busyness also does is it kind of subdues, masks over this voice that any and all of us are hearing at some level. This voice that's constantly kind of whispering that there's more. There's something deeper. That peace is a genuine possibility. That the life that speaks of compassion is real and attainable. So it masks that. I actually have, you know, a Buddhist teacher who's a very profound individual. He described busyness as laziness. which is kind of the opposite, you know, because when I'm busy, I'm really doing, you know, I'm not lazy. I'm up and at it, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm doing whatever it is I'm doing. So I would think he got it wrong. But he described it this way, because obviously his perspective is a little bit different. You know, he's not thinking of busyness as something which is going to add to the bottom line. Busyness is laziness in the sense that to the extent that we load ourselves with ever more and increasing activities, we deny ourselves the time to really do the important work that would actually enable us to put ourselves in touch with the deepest core of our being. You know, that still small voice that they speak about in the Bible, that Buddha nature that is spoken of in Buddhism, that inner ruler immortal present in the hearts of all beings, that is the words of Krishna. And, you know, taking aside all of these authoritative voices, it's that presence within each and every one of us that we all know is there. I don't need Krishna, Buddha, Christ, any of them to tell me about my own experience. We all know it. And in our busyness, we mask it. And in a sense, it seems easier because we don't really have to deal with it right now. And we'll get to it maybe when we retire and have more time for this sort of thing. And, you know, then we retire, the grandkids take over, you know, or whatever it is. So we know the experience. Another way that I see that is a contemporary method of masking and covering over is, you could call it self-medication, you know, where alcohol use, drug use are the sorts of things that really dull this voice down, cover it over, and hide it from us. You know, I had a teacher who used to always say, you know, you can kid anybody you want to. You can tell me anything you want, and I may believe it, but you can't kid yourself. And so we're all involved in the same sort of process. And so that's something that as we move along, and as we really start to find that there is value in even the countless little things, the little moments that we devote to this kind of self-unfoldment, what we start to find at some point is that this whole quest is something that we could really describe as a spiritual quest. It's spiritual in nature. And I always have to kind of like define that word. Because in all honesty, some of you I've told this before, but I reached a point a while back where this word spiritual had gotten to be such a buzzword. You know, everything was spiritual this, spiritual that, that it was starting to lose some sense of meaning. You know, if somebody says spiritual, it could mean, you know, that they go to church on Sunday. Somebody else says spiritual, it could mean that, you know, they do a certain form of yoga. It was just starting to lose meaning for me. And I found myself actually joking about this. I thought it was a joke. Because what I said was, you know, before too long, spirituality is going to become a marketing term. You know, where you're going to have spiritual Air Jordan shoes, you know, or, you know, something like that. I predicted it in joke. You know, I thought I was joking. A couple of years later, here's what happened. I found myself driving through a neighborhood on the north side of Chicago I hadn't been in a while. And as I'm driving through, you know, I just happened to glance to the side, and there's a new store that had opened. And the name of the store? It was a clothing store. It was the Spiritual Boutique. It had arrived. And I thought I was joking. But spirituality, if we just break it down to its most simple sense, when you talk about spirit, the word actually derives from breath. So to breathe. that which gives life to everything that is some form of outgoing and incoming energy that links us with everything that's around us. You know, we all share the same air, and we've breathed in each other's air so many times that this whole idea of we being different ought to just go out on the breeze, we could say, go out on our breath. So spirit and spirituality is that which speaks of oneness, of the interrelationship of all living beings. Anything that moves us in the direction of seeing that, of experiencing that, is a spiritual activity. So I mean, that makes it pretty simple. And, you know, then you can have your shoes, and if that helps, then they could be spiritual too. But, you know, the whole point of it is that which moves us to an appreciation, and beyond appreciation, an experience of oneness. So anyway, in thinking about how to discuss, you know, this whole illumination aspect, I had, actually, I didn't really know what I was going to say when I came up here. Not today, but please believe, I did think about it. I gave myself time to think about it. But prior to this, I'm thinking now how to approach this. Because I have to admit, you know, the title for the, I like the title, you know. To me, it was kind of catchy, Toward an Illumined Mind. And of course, it was mildly ripped off from a book by His Holiness the Dalai Lama called Toward a True Kinship of Faiths. I like the toward part. You know, something about it kind of expresses this movement that we're going toward this state of illumination. So anyway, but then I started to think about probably one of the really foremost and formative kind of spiritual thinkers that really shaped Western civilization, more so than perhaps any other, would be Plato. I mean, a lot of what we do in the Theosophical Society and elsewhere relates to Eastern practices. And a lot of it goes to India, a lot of it goes to Buddhism. And so I think sometimes some of the matching core teachings of Western civilization sometimes get a little overlooked. But he gave this wonderful analogy. I mean, he gave it in the context of ancient Greece, but you find similar ideas cutting across all of the religions of the world. But this wonderful analogy of the cave, and probably many of you know it, but for those of you who don't, I'm just going to run through it briefly, because it's remarkable in terms of its description, the way it kind of consolidates this whole process of unfoldment. It also speaks to the actual event of illumination, and it points to the mechanism that's involved, which is the mind. So anyway, in the analogy of the cave, he talks about people who from birth have been chained in place at the bottom of this cave, where all that they can see, they can't move their heads to the side, they can't look backwards. All they can look at is the wall of the cave in front of them. That's it. But, you know, the cave opens up to the sunlight up above, and some of that sunlight comes in. And he describes how there's a big fire that's burning inside the cave, and that between the fire and the people who are sitting facing the wall, there's this walkway. And so on this walkway from time to time, he says, people come through, and they're carrying different things. They may have, like, shapes that look like animals. They may have different sorts of, you know, vegetables, plants. And so the shadows from them walking by get cast onto the wall. And so all of these people who are sitting chained, the reality that they perceive are these shifting shapes of shadows. It's a beautiful image. I mean, I wouldn't want to be chained there, but well, in fact, we'll get to that because perhaps we are. So these shifting shapes of these images. And, you know, so what ends up happening among the people that are chained is that as they sit there, you know, they start to see who can guess what particular image will pop up next. And the ones that are able to guess, they are regarded as extremely clever and extremely smart. You know, so like in our times, those would be maybe the economists or something like that. You know? They see a shape and it's like, oh, the trend is. But they are the ones who within this community of chained people within a cave watching a shadow world are regarded as the brilliant ones and the foresee. So he says, so now imagine that somebody comes down into that cave and frees one of these people. And so he takes the shackles off them, turns them around, and they turn toward this fire. And in the light of this fire, they see all these people and what they've been carrying, and it makes absolutely no sense to them. It doesn't compute. This is not a shadow. This is, you know, what do you even call this thing? I knew what those shapes were on the wall. What's this? And it would be utter confusion for that person. And then he says, imagine leading them on further, you know, to where they're then looking at the fire. And then imagine bringing them up to the surface of the earth where the sunlight blinds them. But that there would be this period, he says, where at first, in order to see the things around them in the sunlit world, they find themselves looking into like puddles or something to see reflections of things. So this, you know, he's describing this process. All right, so what is it even talking about? I mean, on a certain level, he was using it in some way to talk about a lot of different things. But one of the things that jumps out most clearly, it's a description of the state of unenlightened humanity. That for a certain period of time, we find ourselves as those people who are deep within the cave, the most sort of densest material sort of state you can be in, with your mind is associated with this physical body. You know, we can't get any more deeply materially involved than this, that we actually reach a point where something that we define as spirit is associated with this body, and we start to call this I. So we find ourselves looking at the shadow world. But that at a certain point, there is this kind of opening up. And we move, the mind moves, is what happens. I mean, because the human being that is chained is actually a representation for the mind in one of its lower aspects. And as the mind starts to become freed, the first thing that happens is that it's moving in a very unfamiliar territory. And the thing that's missing are descriptions. You know, you don't know what to call these things that you had seen as shadows before. And so in a sense, he talks about the movement that we experience, and he talks about the nature of the teachers that we come in contact with. Because there's a certain point for all of us where what we think that we're looking for is information. You know, oftentimes, I do believe we find ourselves thinking that if we go to this next lecture, if we attend this next seminar, they're going to give me some piece of information that's going to somehow supply this missing piece that I feel inside. And then it's all going to be all right. I'll have the information, and then I'll know what to do. There is a problem with that way of seeing things. First of all, information, while valuable, does not transform. Information is not transformative. You can know as many things as your head can hold. And one of the problems that we do see in our current society is that very often it's some of the most informed, most knowledgeable people that use this sort of knowledge in the worst ways. You know, see Exxon, you know, see all of the sorts of things, Enron, all the different people who are very knowledgeable, but something else is missing. So there's some other factor that we have to, that has to come in. So the progression from the cave world to the world that's lighted by the fire to the actual surface of the earth where the sun is shining is this movement of the mind toward illumination. When we find ourselves bathed in the rays of the sun, you know, in this case, it's the spiritual sun, then there is a sense that we're somehow in touch with that which actually is essentially spiritual, that which gives life to this world, the sun. There is this story of sorts about the nature of the different people who are teachers in our lives. And it's said that there's a time when there was no fire on the earth. And so what you found was there were people who knew what fire was. And they would sit around the fire together, these ones that knew. And at one point, one of them said, I have to go out here into this darkened world and share with these people about what fire is. So he went out. And he got with the people and he started to describe to them how this thing is hot. You know, if you touch it, it will burn. It gives light. You know, it can cook food, all those different sorts of things. And that was his message. And he left. Another one came out. And this time he actually lit a fire for them. Showed people what a fire was. They did touch it. They did know something about the heat. And this was like a higher order of teacher. Another one came out. He lit the fire. Talked to them about what it is, showed them how to make a fire for themselves. And that was a higher order of teacher. Finally, someone comes out from this group, gathers the people together, stands in front of them, and bursts into flame. That is the example of the Messiah, the Buddha, the avatar, the one who so embodies the teachings or the wisdom that it's not a matter of mere discussion or mere example. It's a matter of the deepest sorts of levels of experience. Because in all of this, basically what all of this leads toward, and the reason why I say all this to begin with is that, you know, these are sort of interesting things, perhaps, you know, to kind of see this progression from darkness, from ignorance, to perhaps belief, to practice, to wisdom. Those things are interesting, but without this further element, which is really what I'd like to talk about more so today, without that, we will always end up somehow lacking. And the missing element for many of us is an element that is the second part of this talk, which is practice. You know, this whole thing about the illumined mind, a rationale for spiritual practice. Mala, good to see you. This is an old friend I haven't seen in several years now. So, what in fact is the value of something that we might call a spiritual practice? And what is a spiritual practice? I think we've talked about what spirituality is, but I think in its simplest form, when we talk about practice, we have all these different ideas. Some people will tell you practice makes perfect. Probably most of our parents or somebody drilled that into us somewhere along the way. Yet another one of those untrue facts. It seems to make sense, and on the surface of it, it would seem to be correct, but when you think about it, I had a good friend many years ago who was an excellent pianist. He couldn't read music to save his life, But, you know, he could play a lot of things. But he wanted to really kind of advance. It took him to a certain level. But when he wanted to advance, and he tried to get people to teach him, he found that he had developed so many bad habits that he had plateaued in terms of his ability to actually play piano. He had reached his limit because he had practiced so diligently in creating these bad habits that they were rooted in him. So practice may make you perfectly wrong. So I think a better way of looking at it might be practice makes perfect, but only perfect practice makes perfect. So from the sense of what it is that we're trying to do in terms of this illumined mind, obviously there's certain specific types of exercises that somebody can do, which I'm not going to attempt to address that today because the exercises are without limit and without number. But just in a broad sense, there are certain things that kind of build into a balanced type of practice. Obviously, one of the things that's required is we do have to get good quality information. It can't stop there. Actually, I know Joseph Campbell. Do many of you know the name Joseph Campbell? He's quite well known for myth and the hero's journey and all that. He was a fellow who, at one time, people were talking about meditation, and he described his particular meditation. And he said, what my meditation is underlining in books. That was his meditation. So in the sense that he gets a book, and when an idea jumps out at him, he goes more deeply into it by underlining it and by rethinking it. So that's of great, great value. Because unless we have some sort of quality information, we can head off in very wrong directions. But that's, again, that's a part of it. So we read or we listen. But then to the extent that we read or we listen, really there's another power within us that has to be invoked as well, which is the power of thought. We have to think. You know, a lot of people try and think spirituality is heart and all else is head. You know, but if you separate any one of these, no matter how you do it, you end up incomplete. So you have to kind of like bear into it and try and let the mind take you where it will, to its depths. And what you really find, even in meditation practice, what you will find is that there's a whole form of meditation called analytical meditation, which involves taking a passage or taking some particular teaching and just thinking it through, following it through from step to step. What you will find is that the mind can take you very far, but if you really bear down on it, you'll find that there will come a point where it can take you no farther. And that's the point, actually, when that does happen, that's the point where true meditation can actually begin. The point where you step away from the highest, deepest thought that has been able to be cultivated within you, and then take that next step. And then that's when meditation begins. The best description I have heard of what is meditation was this sort of halfway funny one, where the fellow Lama Anagarika Govinda, they asked him, you know, what is meditation? And so he says, meditation is not what you think. You got it, right? It's not what you think. At the point that thought quiets down, then actually meditation begins. So study, thinking, meditation, but all of that's not really enough either, because at a certain point, if anything has been able to be cultivated inside of us, then comes the point where just like filling a glass with water. You know, the waters of truth are filled into this glass, this container. But if you just let it sit there, it's going to stagnate. Actually, I had a very clear example of this one time. I'm a member of the YMCA, and I went to work out at the Y. And they had a children's class that they had at the Y. And I guess for some reason, a while back, they had brought in like a fish tank to show them about living things and all that. But it had been a while back. And whoever it is that had started that class must have left, and nobody was cleaning the tank. So, you know, there was this poor goldfish. He's kind of swimming around through all this algae. But beautiful, fresh, pristine water was in there at one point. The kids were looking at it saying, oh, this is a wonderful one. But if the water's not allowed to flow, it stagnates. And it's the same thing with even meditative states. Yes, you can reach and have moments of peace, clarity. And then, ultimately, you're not going to be sitting all the time. So comes a time when you actually get up from the mat or from your meditation corner. And then what do? So, I mean, that peace is the one that makes for this cycle of growth. At a certain point, you actually have to do something. That can take many characters. Doesn't have to be join a local soup kitchen. Doesn't have to be any of that. But you actually have to actively commit to linking this energy, to connecting with others, to acknowledging the fact that there is an interconnection between all of us. If something rises in me, it can rise within you. And so that's sort of sharing that can take place quite actively. I mean, actually, we're going to be doing something here when we start our fall programs, where we're going to have 8 weeks that's going to be completely focused on spiritual practice, theoretical and practical. What do? And one element of that, and I just talked with Marilyn Johnson today, one element of that is going to be actually the cultivation of healing. So I have always been of the mind that anybody who has any sort of spiritual realization is by nature a healer. It doesn't mean that you lay your hands on someone. Some people do that very effectively. But it necessarily means that whatever it is that develops in your consciousness spreads itself to others in a way that they experience it as healing. It's good to be around you. I feel safe in the presence of. I feel uplifted. And they maybe didn't even say a word. You know, all of that is the qualities that we kind of build into ourselves as this mind starts to become illumined. There's a little verse in the Bible, you know, like so many that are overlooked. And I don't even know where it is, so I'll just give you the verse. The prayers of a righteous man, and of course, biblical language is going to be a man. The prayers of a righteous man availeth much. The prayers that come out of someone who has kind of rooted themselves in a sense of the oneness of all life have great power. They avail much. And any direction you point your consciousness, you point it and healing is experienced. And again, we're not necessarily talking about reversing a heart condition, but we are talking about a power that is really one of the reasons for embarking on this spiritual path. I think initially we conceive of a spiritual path or a spiritual search as something that's going to benefit us. It's going to help me to become whatever it is I want. You know, I want to be more happy. It'll help me with that. I want a sense of peace. It will help me with that. I want contentment. It will help me with that. And that's true. But the tricky thing that always ends up happening That's a good beginning. But it always ends up happening. As you move along, you start to find that, yes, all those things are true. But then the only way that they actually can happen is when you start to actually focus on others. I mean, all these spiritual teachers don't tend to tell you that stuff at the beginning, but along the way you start to find that if I'm going to be happy, it can't happen in an unhappy world. You know, I have to be focused on bringing up someone else's happiness. If I'm going to experience peace, it's not going to happen with me just sitting here while the world is beating at my door and crying and gnashing its teeth. It's going to happen in the middle of all of that. So, you know, sometimes I wonder, is there a greater need for spiritual practice today than in past times? And, you know, thinking about that for today, you know, I came to the conclusion that really it completely depends on where I'm looking at it from. From the individual perspective, no, there's no greater need for spiritual practice. I mean, obviously, spiritual practice will always result in this sort of sense of happiness, peace, compassion, all of that. And that's been true throughout the ages. But when we start to think in terms of the world that we live in, 2011, and I don't need to start going through the levels of problems that we're facing. But one of the things that stands out most clearly is that all of these sorts of problems, one of the main things that we see is that we are so tightly interconnected that what happens with one person in some little funny part of the world can spread throughout the whole in ways that were absolutely impossible in previous times. And so what that demands of the spiritual citizen of our time is a deeper responsibility and a deeper connection with this sort of illumination that doesn't just shine on us, but that shines outward toward all people. And that's something that is worth cultivating. It's something that requires some level of practice. So, you know, I think my time, I had hoped I'd have time for questions, but I found I ran my mouth too long. So what I would encourage you is, those of you who do have a practice, continue to commit to it. Find ways to deepen it. Those of you who do not, by all means, try and find some time to cultivate those things that you want for others. All right. Thank you.